Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club.
This is the Commonwealth Club of California. Find us on the internet at www.commonwealthclub.org. I'm Ann Clark, a member of the Commonwealth Club and chair of the Environment and Natural Resources member-led forum. Our program tonight is NRDC and India's Clean Energy Future. Our moderator is Susan Casey Lekovich, Chief Program Officer, NRDC. Susan, will you introduce our panel members?
I'd be happy to, Anne. Thank you so much for having us. Our thanks to the Commonwealth Club, and welcome to all of you. As Anne said, I'm Susan Casey Lefkowitz with the Natural Resources Defense Council. And tonight we're going to be discussing India's clean energy future. It is such an exciting topic. I think you all know that India is really on the point of a clean energy revolution right now. With air pollution having grown so bad and technology for clean energy having made it so possible, India is really starting to lead the world in clean energy, and our team is working closely with partners in India on solutions to help us advance more quickly in this regard. So I'd like to give you a sense of who our panel is, and then I just wanted to say a few more words to set the stage for tonight's discussion. So we're going to start with Anjali Jaiswal. She is the director and founder of NRDC's India program and has been working in India for over 10 years on environment, climate change, and clean energy work. Then next, we're going to be joined by Shilpa Patel. And Shilpa is the direction of Mission Investing at Climate Works Foundation. Then we'll hear from Poonam Sandhu. And Poonam is a senior clean energy finance expert and a managing consultant with NRDC. And then we'll turn to Sean Randolph, who will help us close our discussion for the evening. He is the president of the Bay Area Council Economic Institute. So I think you all know that India has been experiencing very rapid growth. And growth, of course, leads to a lot of energy use. So India has been really struggling with how to handle that energy use, especially as a country that is dealing with extreme poverty and with many people who don't have access to energy. And so part of what we're going to explore tonight are the types of solutions, especially in the finance world, that India is more and more turning to be very creative about how to advance clean energy in the face of extreme air pollution and in the face of climate change, which is, of course, impacting countries around the world. But India has especially been feeling these impacts in the realm of extreme heat and flooding and impacts on agriculture. So I'd like to also just acknowledge our India team. This is actually the launch for us of a week of a strategic planning retreat from all of our team that works on India-related issues and with our partners in India. And if everyone who works for NRDC with the India team could just raise your hand so that we can acknowledge you. It's a wonderful growing team, and they do really incredible work, many based in Delhi and some based here in the United States. So Anjali, would you like to lead us off?
Sure. I'm going to stand too. Well, thank you, Susan. Susan's been a longtime mentor of mine too when she was director of the international program and all the trips to India. So it's an honor to be on the panel with all of you. And Anne, a special thanks to you too. That gavel reminded me of my first Commonwealth Club event. This is such an important gathering. So for all of the audience here and all the Commonwealth Club members in particular, thank you so much for being here tonight with us. And it's such a critical time to have this discussion because India's election results will be announced this Thursday. So all eyes on India. And a key question that a lot of us have at NRDC and our partners is, what is the future of India's clean energy growth and trajectory? Where will it go? Well, Susan, you referred to this, so it's very critical. I think sometimes, you know, as we're sitting here in San Francisco in this beautiful building, and where the United States is on its trajectory, to realize that what India is trying to do is actually very hard. It's actually never been done before. It's a major economy, the second, or by some estimates, the fastest growing major economy, most second most populous nation, largest democracy, and it is working to bring millions of people out of poverty while powering its economy through clean energy. No country's done that before. And it's an honor, it's really exciting for NRDC to be able to work on that. So I'm going to talk about three main areas to watch and then highlight some of our partnerships. We've been working in India for 10 years and a lot of our teams here, I'm really happy to see them here. So the first, of course, is around India's Paris targets and clean energy targets. India made ambitious yet achievable targets at Paris. Think about where we are. I was at the Paris Agreement. Susan was there. Jake Schmidt was there from our team, several of us. And I was sweating bullets. Tony, you were there. So you remember that, too. Because at the time, India was really portrayed as a villain. Modi, his first election, what is this guy going to do? There are good things, and there are many bad things that Modi's done. I mean, I'm sure, you know, a lot of there's a big discussion, a separate talk on that. But India was really portrayed as a villain. And is India going to agree to the Paris Agreement? And where we are now in the United States and what the United States has done and where we see Brazil. You see India really emerging as a clean energy leader, yet also balancing the needs to bring people out of poverty and being able to transition to clean energy, build clean energy, and not just rely on coal. So solar energy is a huge opportunity. When we first started working in India, NRDC, at the time, there was virtually zero solar energy, 17 megawatts. That's very little solar energy. Today, India has over nearly 30,000 megawatts of energy. That's nearly the same as this state, California. That is half of the United States' solar energy supply. That's the solar target. It's the centerpiece. Wind energy, similar. India is the fifth largest wind energy producer. Major opportunities there. Now you're seeing EVs, electric vehicles, and mobility with the announcement of the FAME II program that just came out that ramps up and 10 times increases the investment. I'm looking at Charu because she leads that work. 10 times the investment on electric vehicles. Same thing for batteries and storage. So a major opportunity around renewable energy. All the reports that are coming out are that India is going to achieve its clean energy targets. Land use is another issue. Now, Tony, you asked me a question and I prepared for this. What about coal? And we had dinner last night, the team, Samir, we were researching and we were talking about that earlier. So there were some Bloomberg New Energy articles, others Indian government. Yes, India is still very much reliant on coal energy, 70%. A little under, of India's energy, electricity comes from coal. And the coal is bad. The coal, I've been to the coal mines. It's buried in the ground. And we're on top of where people live. So yes, coal use will go up because India's reducing its energy intensity. But overall, India's emissions will rise. However, the rate at which coal plants are growing compared to solar plants or wind plants is much slower. India's government intentionally and on purpose, and also not just the government, business, because business has a huge role to play in India, is investing in clean energy. And we're going to hear about finance and how finance is critical. So I'm happy to talk more about coal and all and its ramifications. So that is definitely a huge part of it. The second big area to watch that we might forget, especially here, is cooling and energy efficiency. Now, of course, if you know NRDC, you know we love energy efficiency. But cooling is, the last century, most of our energy expenditures were spent on heating, keeping places warm. You know, a lot of North America was built out, Europe. This next century, what we're going to see is a dramatic focus on cooling. You're going to see that in India, South Asia, Southeast Asia, with a huge rise across the board. You're also going to see major infrastructure. A McKinsey statistic, which is a little stale, but says 80% of India's infrastructure, roads, buildings, all that, have yet to be built by 2030. So we're seeing a major ramp up in construction. So what does that mean? Right now, if you go to India, it's really hot right now. It's over 100 degrees in most of the cities in India right now. So that also drives the need for cooling. And it's not just a matter of being comfortable. It's a matter of productivity. It's a matter of human health. And that's an area that we work on in India as well. So one of the things that NRDC is doing, in addition to helping frame the solar policy, the solar mission, working on EV policies and programs in specific states. We have also helped and are one of the main partners working on India's cooling action plan, the ICAP. So India's already set targets for making air conditioners more efficient. And I've skipped a major point. Why is it so important to work on air conditioners? Why do report after report say it's the number one thing? It is because of HFCs, hydrofluorocarbons, which many of you in this room know is one of the six greenhouse gases and has thousands of times of potential of warming than carbon dioxide. It is a lethal super pollutant, and it is one that we have an opportunity to nip in the bud and really work on it. NRDC and our team is behind that. PREMA's working on that with our team and advancing that work. The third big area to watch, of course, if you are reading about India, if you go there, air pollution. There's really no healthy city in India right now on air pollution. You know, the Lancet report that came out, report after report, showing the effects of the construction boom, of vehicles moving, and what that does with small particles lodging in lungs, what that does to children, what that does to mothers. It's a huge problem in India. The good thing is that we at NRDC and many of the people who are here in California know that air pollution is a problem that we have solutions to. We know how to deal with air pollution. And we're working, Fulash with our team, we're working with partners in India to help solve and work on air pollution. And in California, we've seen, since we've had our air pollution problems, double population, triple vehicle miles, fifth largest economy in the world. You can have clean air, you can grow your population, and you can grow your economy. So those are the three main areas to watch. The last thing to sum up, I was going to talk about our partners that we work with. And we have the honor of working with the Self-Employed Women's Association, SEWA, working on bringing clean energy, solar, to rural India. Madhura Joshi with our team leads that work, along with Samir Quatra. And we've been working on transforming the ways that villages use clean energy. And we can talk more about that, but to the point where it increases their livelihoods by 94%. And these are people that are living below the poverty line. So it's a huge problem. So it's such an honor. And what I'll say in conclusion, you know, I think the Commonwealth Club really embodies this, is that all problems are global. And NRDC is working globally. But we know that all solutions are local. So that really the solutions we built are the solutions we built together with our partners.
Thank you, Anjali. That was such a wonderful context setting. And Shilpa, we'd like to turn to you next and maybe help us understand, going bigger picture now, some of the context for finance and how finance can be one of the key solutions to dealing with a number of the sticky issues that Anjali laid out.
Thank you. And thank you for having me on this panel. And thank you all for coming out to listen to us. So for those of you who don't know ClimateWorks, we are a global philanthropic organization based here in San Francisco with a staff of about 70 people. Essentially, what we do is to bring philanthropy foundations together to be more effective and strategic in a collective response to climate change. So we have deep expertise in climate-related areas, and my role, which is that of Director of Mission Investing, allows me to work with different foundations and interesting and innovative approaches to climate finance. I know we're here to talk about India, but before I dive into that, let's just step back for a moment and talk about the scale of the problem that we're dealing with. Now, we are more than midway between the commitments made in Paris and 2020, by when we really need to have bent the emissions curve and be well set on a path to decarbonization. So what's that going to take? Now, the UNFCCC estimates that $1.5 trillion of investment will be needed annually to 2030. And actually, so this may even be on the low side, because I've seen estimates that go up to $3.5 trillion annually. Now, investment in low carbon, climate resilient technologies is really critical to fight climate change, and also to be able to respond to the impacts that climate change will have on us. So the very future of our planet literally is riding on this. Now, that's overall for climate-related action. What about renewable energy? So the International Renewable Energy agency estimates that about $700 billion of investment will be needed annually, again to 2030, in renewables to stay within our climate commitments and targets. Just for context, that is twice the amount that is being invested than is being invested today. Now let's come to India. What's the situation there? Now, the government has set a pretty ambitious target of 175 gigawatts of renewables by 2022. Current installed capacity, as you just said, is around 70 if you take all renewables together, 75 actually if you include small hydro. In terms of investment, what that's going to need, according to estimates that I've seen, is $18 billion a year. And this does not include the investment that's going to be needed for electrification of vehicles, where the government also has ambitious targets. So that's just going to add, if you want that to be powered by clean energy, that's just going to add to the amount of renewables that will be needed. So against this need, how is India actually doing in terms of investment? Last year, investment in renewables amounted to something like $11 billion, so still short of the $18 billion needed. But I think there's reason to be optimistic because India is actually an attractive destination for renewable investments. And let me just go into a few reasons why. Ernst & Young does a country ranking in terms of attractiveness for renewables. And although India has slipped a bit recently, it's still at number four position. So why is India attractive for renewables? Well, first of all, it does have aggressive targets, and those are backed by policy support. So you have fiscal incentives such as feed-in tariffs, but also grid access. So you can have private developers that are able to feed into the grid. Another important factor really is that it's very well diversified in terms of location of projects. So India is a large country, but many parts of the country are suitable and amenable for renewables production. And India is growing steadily and has improving economic indicators in terms of attractiveness for investment. So it's going up in the World Economic Forum's competitiveness rank index and in the IFC's ease of doing business. So solar is fast growing, again, as Anjali, you mentioned, particularly as prices come down the cost curve. Recent auctions have revealed prices that are frankly unimaginably low, you know, less than 3 rupees or that's less than 4 US cents per kilowatt hour, and more than competitive with thermal generation. And India also has a vibrant private sector in solar, particularly utility and grid-connected solar. So these tier one companies are able to raise capital from foreign investors and development banks and are also able to access credit markets locally. But within solar, and this is what I really want to focus the rest of my remarks on, there is an opportunity that is currently going underserved and which has huge development impact through social impacts like improved livelihoods, health and food safety, financial sector development more generally with all its attendant multiplier effects. I'm talking about distributed generation. So this is rooftop solar, mini grids, even solar appliances like irrigation pumps. This is a market that is served by small-scale developers whose clients are themselves SMEs or small and medium enterprises. Now, SMEs are really the backbone of the Indian economy, and they account for about 25 or 30% of power consumption in India today. But these tier two developers and their clients are not able to get formal credit, and so they've grown their businesses on the backing of family and friends, which puts a natural brake to how quickly they can grow. The big issue facing them is the lack of track record or other data to assess their credit worthiness, which combined with the small ticket size of these transactions makes it very difficult to obtain debt at reasonable rates. And so consequently, the solar market has been largely underbanked and underserved. So recognizing this, a consortium of philanthropic foundations came together in the India Catalytic Solar Finance Program, which is a notional $20 million commitment designed to catalyze and mobilize financing for distributed generation. And we at ClimateWorks and I personally have been very involved in this program. So this program really consists of two separate areas of activity. One is a number of individual transactions that seek to develop and encourage financial intermediation in this sector to invest in mini grids, for example, to invest in these tier two developers and help them amass portfolios of projects that can be bundled and aggregated and eventually refinanced to get capital flowing, to work with existing SME lenders and get them to do rooftop finance and so on. And so I'm happy to talk about this later. I know that we have other speakers coming. The other component of this is market building support. And this is things like credit guarantee mechanisms, green banking, foreign exchange mitigation instruments, and so on. And so we've been this consortium has been providing support to these two levels of activity. So I'm going to stop here, but I'm hoping that Poonam will talk a little bit more about some of this capacity building activities that we are seeing happening. Thank you.
Thank you, Shilpa. That was wonderful. It was a really excellent context setting. And Poonam, would you now take us maybe kind of to that next level of detail in terms of what's happening in India? And I think what you are planning probably builds excellently on how Shilpa set the stage.
Yes. Thanks, Susan. And let me start by saying that I'm really thankful to the Commonwealth Club for the invitation to speak on India's progress in sustainable finance and also on NRDC's work in India. I wonder if some of us here are wondering what climate change in India has to do with their lives in the USA. So I would say plenty. Climate change related, for example, let me take my favorite topic, chocolate. If climate change related drought leads to no cocoa production in Ghana, it would be disastrous. There'd be, where would the chocolates come from, you know? So, but this joke apart, I know the audience here is actually very aware and we understand how climate change is actually a global concern, not limited to one country alone. And climate change in one country will impact lives of people in other countries as well. So I feel really honored to be in the midst of thought leaders here today in this room and to be at this forum that has heard from truly visionary personalities such as Hillary Clinton, I hear. With that, let me offer a few thoughts on the progress on sustainable finance in India. And I'll take over from Shilpa, who set the context on the developments in India as far as a distributed renewable sector as well as the large grid-connected projects are concerned. So some of the sources of sustainable finance in India have been overseas development assistance to the tune of $3 billion per year, climate funds, about $1 billion per year, domestic corporate social responsibility funding, again around $1 billion per year, and then there are a few billion per year that come in through impact funds, which are supported by philanthropic and responsible investors. But what we really need, and the figures we heard from Shilpa are quite huge. I mean, $18 billion per year for renewables alone. If I put it in the context of sustainable financing, the figure is $4.5 trillion till the year 2040. That means plenty of billions of dollars per year. So these sources of funding, which are public sources by way of overseas development assistance or climate funding, is definitely important and gets us started and is able to fund demonstration projects. But what we really need is for commercial banks and mainstream funding to flow into sustainable projects. And here, We've had some progress with all the demonstration financing which has been done over the years, but and I can give a few examples, like State Bank of India, which is the largest bank in India, has now started increasing the environmental, social, and governance factors that it applies to its credit. So that means they are financing more sustainable projects now. A mid-sized bank like Yes Bank has issued green deposits. So the public has subscribed to these green deposits. So these are small. I mean, it's a small amount of, say, 160 million, but it's a start. There's other funding which happens in the area of sustainable finance. Like Shilpa mentioned, that we have large grid-connected solar projects that get financed by commercial funding. But what we want is for money to flow into areas like distributed renewable energy. There are new technologies in the area of maybe electric mobility as well as hybrid projects. We need funding from commercial segment to flow into these projects. And so we want sustainability to enter the DNA of the financial system, which includes not just banking, but even capital markets. So today we have about $6.5 billion of green bonds that have been raised for Indian sustainable and green projects. But we need many more billions to come through from the capital markets and from IPOs. So this is what we want, and this is what we need for commercial finance to start financing this as part of sustainable projects, as part of their regular financing. So what is NRDC's India team doing to support or to enhance financing to and get more commercial financing into sustainable projects? We are working with the Ministry of New and Renewable Energy in developing solutions to expand the financing market for renewable energy by developing an ecosystem that can cater to the financing needs of all types of clean energy projects. So the aim here is to draw in commercial financing into especially the underserved areas that we spoke of, like distributed renewable energy and newer clean energy technologies. So these new untested business models, as mentioned by Shilpa, they are perceived to be risky, and hence commercial lenders stay away. What we are doing here is to establish a green bank-like structure that will have access to low-cost public capital. But with that limited low-cost public capital, they are able to offer risk mitigation or instruments that are able to lower the perception of risk of commercial lenders and thereby leverage in or draw in commercial financing. So this is done commonly by green banks in the United States and other parts of the developed world. And this is what we are trying to and do with the Ministry of New and Renewable Energy and with their flagship financial institution called IREDA, or Indian Renewable Energy Development Agency. Other than the green bank like structure, which we call green windows in India, we're calling it green windows. There are other areas that we're working with, as mentioned by Anjali, in the in getting access to energy for the underserved segments of the population in India that don't have access to energy yet, or minimum access. We're also working in the area of electric mobility to assist state governments in expediting and developing their electric vehicle policies and viable charging infrastructure models. So let me just end by a bit of information on the upcoming election results, and the news here being that exit polls are indicating that the incumbent party and prime minister will be back. The vote bank apparently is still the first-time voters and aspirational Indians, and some consolidation also of the constituency of the poor. So this is surprising. We felt that this is a pro-capitalist party, but apparently even the poorer classes are convinced that the incumbent party has a welfare model to offer with all their schemes of toilets and LPG and housing. So in effect, what it means is that the path to sustainable development in India is irreversible, irrespective of which party comes in. And of course, there's more to be done in terms of involving the private sector into infrastructure and into funding the growth story for sustainable development in India, create new jobs, prevent the flight of capital away from India and attracting new foreign capital. But the fact is that sustainable development cannot be stopped by any political party. It's critical to the success of any government, in fact. So I feel confident that India will stay on its path to sustainable development, and the financial sector will have to align itself to the needs of the country.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Hear thousands of our podcasts on iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 500 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. Now, back to our program.
So, Sean, it would be great if you could now share with us your thoughts on the role of business. You know, finance is such an important tool in India, but we're seeing it all over the world, that financial incentives and systems have just become critical to sustainable development. And so we'd love to hear your thoughts to kind of bring it home also in terms of the India-U.S. connection.
Absolutely. And I'll bring it home to the Bay Area connection to India, which is very important here. I think there's three unique points of connection between the Bay Area and India on this theme of renewable energy and climate change. One is the Indian diaspora here, the largest in the U.S. Indians here are phenomenally successful. Per capita income or average family income, well above $100,000. Highly educated, and Indians are prominently scattered through the top ranks of our research institutions, our laboratories, our companies, and the venture capital industry. So there is a community here that understands India. They came out of India at one point or another, and they're a bridge back into India. They get how things work there. And they have a lot of technical expertise to bring to the table, which they do. The other unique point of connection is state and local policies, where it's not the only leader, but California has probably been the primary leader among American states in pursuing, going back at least four decades, aggressive energy efficiency policies, which have saved consumers here enormous amounts of money and helped to create a more competitive industry in California because it is very energy efficient. And a lot of that goes to the state policies that predated renewable energy and predated climate change. Then, of course, under Governor Schwarzenegger, we had AB 32, the nation's first state-level global warming law, SB 375, a whole series of other initiatives and laws implemented after Schwarzenegger by Governor Brown, which will be carried forward certainly by Governor Newsom now. So California is out there, and the cities of California, including San Francisco and many others here in the Bay Area, are in the forefront among cities across the U.S. in aggressively pushing and implementing renewable energy standards, efficiency standards for buildings, a whole range of things that are very, very relevant to some of the challenges in India. The third point of connection, I think, is where we get onto the business side. And that has to do, actually, business and research. It's the reservoir of technology capacity here in the Bay Area, the private research laboratories, the federal research laboratories, the university-affiliated laboratories, many of which are very, very focused as important parts of their long-term programs on renewable energy and climate research. That folds into the venture community. The venture industry was created here in the Bay Area. Historically, about one-third of all the venture investment of the United States takes place right here in the Bay Area. If you went to the top of the Salesforce Tower on a clear day, you would see where this is all taking place just within a line of sight. The last several years, 45 to 50% of all the venture investment in the U.S. has been here. Some part of that goes into clean and renewable energy. Some part of that is invested overseas. And so when we look at the role of the private sector beyond green banks and traditional finance, certainly there's an enormous role, potential role for venture investment to play as our VCs look out across the world. There are examples. We just throw out a few examples. So Bessemer Venture, for example, early investor in a company called Applied Solar Technologies. It's a Delhi-based firm. It provides decentralized off-grid solar power to business customers in sectors with networked assets, such as telecom towers, base stations, bank ATMs, that would historically be powered by diesel power. Another venture firm, Capricorn, invested later on. They're the fund manager for Skoll Corporation here. And the last we saw, the company had about 4,000 distributed solar power sites across India. Another local company here called D-Light, it grew out of UC Berkeley. They began with an original design for solar-powered lantern that sells very low-cost solar-powered lanterns, chargers and microgrid solutions for homes and small businesses, but they're deploying these very often in rural areas that are hard to get to. And the investors include Omidyar Networks here, Nexus Venture Partners, and the Mahindra Group, because these are international fundings. Maybe a third example, another company called GrandPower. They installed India's first solar-powered microgrid, smart microgrid, at a village with just 200 people in Rajasthan, provided energy for lights, machines, televisions, fans. They started with an $80,000 seed grant from Alibaba. Now, remember, these are international fundings. Intel and UC Berkeley. The initial funding to distribute this in India came from rural electrification programs, but private utilities are now making large orders for smart meters. So what we can see here is that as the needs and opportunities for this kind of investment in India become more and more apparent with pollution, climate change, and government policies, then there's a unique opportunity for investors here to connect. And I think it's also worth pointing out the R&D aspect of this. As I mentioned earlier, private laboratories, but especially federal research laboratories here in the Bay Area, are extremely active and have been for decades in India. Lawrence Berkeley Laboratory has been especially active. They've been doing studies working with Indian government partners in particular on, for example, the potential of wind energy in India, financial and emissions impact of grid-connected renewable energy, cost assessments for renewable energy grid integration, demand-side management, a whole range of things, also including implications across a range of issues for the absorption and expansion of electrical vehicles, you know, across India, and what are the implications of that for things like grid load and EV charging. So there's a lot, and also energy efficiency in buildings. This has been a major long-term focus with federal funding at Lawrence Berkeley Lab. So there's a lot of technology expertise that's available and is actually being deployed, but there's also a lot of potential investment capital that could go into India. And I think what is really important to focus on now, especially in terms of where the current election seems to be coming out, is that not that many years ago, I think India, this kind of activity in India was the territory of nonprofit organizations and multilateral agencies, but India was largely off limits for business. It was not a terribly receptive place for U.S. or other foreign companies to come in and invest. A lot of uncertainty about regulation and inefficiency and corruption, but also it was just not a very friendly environment for, let's say, a U.S. company to come in and invest over the longer term. That has changed significantly under Prime Minister Modi. I think when he was elected on his first term, I think people really took notice in the business community. He's gone a long distance to project India as a place that you can do business. It's friendly for investment. I think his initiative, his digital initiatives across India, his whole suite of initiatives have been, I think, convinced a lot in the business community that actually there is a lot of change that can happen and that actually will happen in India, which was not always the case looking back 10 or 20 years as business looks at India. So I think if, in fact, the current government is returned, I think that will be a point of reassurance for investors from the U.S., including potential investors in energy and renewable energy, that they can invest for the long term.
Great. Thank you so much, Sean. And it is true, you know, not only India, but countries around the world really look to California, both for its regulation and for the industry here, both as a model. And we've seen that time and time again, especially in India, with the kind of interest that there is in following what happens in California and in making those kinds of connections with the many businesses that you spoke of. So I think we are ready to turn to the questions. I was just leafing through them, and they're really wonderful questions. I think that we have enough time that we can try taking them one by one, and maybe not everyone has to answer each one, but we can kind of go through them, and then we'll make sure we have a minute or two for a little wrap-up at the very end. So the first question is, if you could do a timeline of decarbonization for the next 10 years, given the flow of capital, what are the three major steps that need to be accomplished?
That's a very big question, very difficult to unpack in a short amount of time. But I think that if you look at where the big potential is for decarbonization, I think we have to look at transport. I think power is on its way, I would say. I think, but transport is much newer and it probably requires a lot more support. And I would say we absolutely have to look at land use, because that is a carbon store and a carbon sink. I think carbon removal let's hope there's a technological breakthrough and people are working on it. But forests are carbon removal assets, and they're right there. So we need to definitely protect them and manage them sustainably. And land use in general, with a growing population, you have growing needs for food. The world is getting richer, and so diets are changing in many parts of the world and becoming much more carbon intensive. If you look at meat consumption, that's rising and so on. So I would say we would have to look at those things.
Yeah. Those are definitely tops of many lists in many countries. Would others like to add to that?
I might just add that it's a slower boat to turn, but I think making these changes in the rural areas is going to be extremely important. The Modi government has focused a lot on the rural areas. It's not just the big cities. There's energy consumption is actually really, really low there. On the other hand, pollution levels are really, really high. Just from the nature of the energy that's used in rural areas. So there's an enormous needed potential for, microgrids, locally distributed energy, this highly efficient and economical models for doing that. So I think there is some capacity here in the Bay Area and elsewhere to kind of help on those issues. But I think one of the big shifts to turn is going to be lowering pollution and less use of fossil fuels and things like biomass in rural areas.
Mm. I was just going to add one thing. In our work, the lesson that I think is the most critical, because we work globally and on finance, like we work with the New York Green Bank and the UK Green Bank, it's a need for the government to use its very limited public funds to use those limited public funds for underserved areas like rooftop solar or emerging areas like battery technology, and to fuel those and then to bring in the international investment and the large domestic capital that exists in India, for example. Mm. I think it's more like the way that the capital is spent. I think we could have a nice long discussion on the areas too.
Yeah. Well, and two of the next questions build on some of these answers. So let me go to one of them, which is that there is substantial evidence that a large fraction of air pollution in India comes from household energy needs, including biomass combustion. So can you discuss any work you're doing or ideas that you have to address rural household energy needs, which we were just touching on a minute ago?
Well, we have a big project on that.
Yeah.
So,
do you want to talk about it?
No, go ahead.
On air pollution. Sorry.
And rural energy needs specifically.
Right. So, considering that India is now almost 100% electrified, but the electrification is still very minimal in most remote areas. So rural energy needs, this is a good place to start with getting them started with clean energy and thereby reducing or at the very beginning, making sure that you don't have the problems of air pollution that the bigger cities have to deal with due to the sources of fuel that they use and the sources of power that they use. So, I think getting clean energy to by way of microgrids or by way of distributed renewable appliances would be a good way to handle this issue and also get livelihoods going.
Mm-hmm. And to add to what Poonam's saying is that we have an exciting new project area that Mother is lighting up that we're working on with the Self-Employed Women's Association. And we have two pilot villages and we're planning to scale it to at least 10 to 15. Now, if you know Seva, it's a powerhouse group of micro-lending. It's a trade union of women. And we've just conducted our first set of surveys in two villages in India to see how are the villages using electricity there, energy there, so not just electricity, but also non-electrified forms of energy, and how to transform those to clean energy using the state and national government policies that exist. So that's definitely one area that we're very excited about.
Yeah. So the next question that's linked to these topics is, given the huge employment co-benefits of decentralized micro and small renewable sector, what can be done to promote rapid scaling up of such kind of adoption? And I think all of you pretty much touched on the importance of looking at the smaller scale renewable energy as well as the large scale. So maybe let's try to dig into that topic a little bit more.
So perhaps I can I can go first. So I think I alluded to this, that the thing about distributed generation and small scale energies, that the ticket sizes are small, and you know, and contracts are very disparate. So one of the things that needs to be done is to bring in a certain amount of standardization so that you can bundle small projects together and, you know, aggregate them and create enough critical size that makes it attractive to be refinanced. Now, that has two benefits, at least, if not more. The first one is that it frees up capital because it brings in new sources of capital that haven't gone into this segment before. And so it frees up capital for the developers to do more of this. But over time, it has another big benefit. If you start standardizing and if you start getting these portfolios, you can bring in securitization. And then all of a sudden, you can make it attractive for institutional investors that are sitting on trillions of dollars of money in your pension fund and your insurance companies and so on to invest in this. And this also is very amenable to getting this little amount of public money that might be available to come in and provide credit enhancement or de-risking or something that makes the instrument palatable to for investment. So it's really that sort of financial engineering, if you will, is what's needed to get money flowing at scale. Well, that's one way.
Mm-hmm.
I would like to add that to get the distributed sector going, there's a significant amount of capacity building also which is required at the level of the user, which is also, of course, a function of being able to offer the right type of solutions to them and making them aware of them and making them aware of the choices that they have. There is also a lot of capacity building which would be required at the level of the financier, because the small lending will not be done by the large banks. It will normally be done by the local NBFC or the microfinance company. So they too need to understand and how these financing models can work, what these new products are all about. Like, for example, microgrid financing, it's a different ballgame altogether. So a lot of capacity building is required, and that's an area that needs a lot of focus as well.
And there's a bit of a broader background, too. This isn't the heart of the topic, but I think it's the wallpaper, which is the government's really aggressive and positive push on digitization across the board in India. There's a range of, let's say, aggressive policies across a range of sectors to, like, digitize healthcare, bring digital services into rural areas, digitize the distribution of government benefits, allow people to access government services digitally, and not just in the cities, but to extend that into rural areas. And so to the extent that these rural communities and villages aren't isolated, that they're actually connected and they have information and they can access government services digitally, you're further on the road where they become more financially viable for investment, and people can see their options, and there can be public education about some of these transitions that might not come quickly or easily in a traditional rural community, but might come faster with the kind of information and services that are available now.
Great, thank you. So one other point that this next question really builds on, I believe, Sean, that you had ended with it when you were talking about how the government in India has really been changing over time, and India is not a risky investment proposition like it might have been longer ago in the past. And so this question is, how challenging has it been to navigate the bureaucratic structure and the center-state dynamics while working in India? And what I would add is maybe comment on how things have been changing and what that has meant for environmental work.
Yeah, I think the perception, not just in the business community, but generally, but especially in business over decades, has been that India was this really promising place, but immensely complex to navigate and costly. That I think the government's policies were, and labor policies, just the weight of bureaucracy extended the time required to get anything accomplished. And actually, a lot of people actually ended up going to China. Because whatever can you say about China, the government could make things happen quickly. That saved a lot of cost. You could see things happening quickly, so people have confidence that it actually in China you could do something and you could do it quickly. In India, there was not confidence you could do anything quickly. So I think the big change has been a perception that, aha, maybe now in India you can do things relatively quickly. That the government is more prepared to work with you to enable those things to happen. So I don't think anybody would say that it's nirvana. It's not just great yet, but I think most people who watch it would say there's been a very visible improvement in the last 4 years in the receptivity and the environment for companies coming into India. They still need to work with bureaucracy. There's a lot of policies that are issues and frustrations, but it's like you can do business in India now. I think the other thing that's really interesting, though, which we advise the people we work with, is that it's not just the national policies, it's the state policies. And kind of like in the U.S., states can be and are laboratories for experimentation and innovation, and some Indian states are, you know, very forward-looking. They're closer to the voters, closer to the constituents, and often they're implementing these policies, often in partnership with nonprofit organizations, multilateral agencies, but also with businesses. as aggressively, if not more aggressively, than the national government. So I think it's really important to keep an eye not just on what's happening at the national level, but which states are moving fastest, and those are the ones that people will look to partner with.
Great. Well, we're going to start wrapping up now, and so what I wanted to do was to just give each of you a chance to sort of leave us with a final thought about the importance of India and the path that it's on to advance clean energy. And so Anjali Jaiswal, NRDC India Program Director, why don't you lead us off?
Sure. I'll say this more for myself personally, maybe on what kind of motivates me, why clean energy is very important. I have two nephews in the Bay Area, and I have a lot of family in India, too. I have two nephews here, Roshan and Chetan, and Roshan loves olives, but not any olives. He loves Kalamata olives, Bay Area kid. And then my other nephew, Chetan, he doesn't like just brie or cheese. He likes double cream brie, right? So when they come over, they live down the street. And I travel to India a lot. I go to India and see my family there, and then I'm in Delhi. And I was there on it was right when the air pollution stories were starting to really break and how bad it was. And there was a young boy out there selling books, you know, probably lived on the streets. And he kind of reminded me of my nephews when I saw him at first. And he was selling a book. And, you know, I also like chocolate. So I have a chocolate or like money, which I know mixed reviews of whether to give it. But anyways, And he comes up very proudly, and he's, like, selling me his book. And then I see him, and he's got this horrible respiratory illness going on. And, you know, there's the IPCC report that just came out, right, this fall. Very motivating. But for me, I think about Bill McKibben's quote, right, that this work on saving the planet, on fighting climate change, is the same type of work in terms of equity, the people who live here, and those boys on the street.
Thank you. And now Shilpa Patel, Director of Mission Investing at Climate Works Foundation, what final thought would you like to leave us with?
Well, I think the thought that I'd like to put out there is that, you know, India is the second most populous country in the world, and some people say it will become the most populous in a few years. And I think it has natural aspirations to lift its people out of poverty, to give everybody a decent life. And it's very difficult to give people a decent life if they don't have clean air to breathe, if they don't have access to modern energy, and if they don't have the ability to prepare for a future in which, you know, education and the ability to adapt quickly is going to be really, really important. So you have to bring all these people into what I would call the 21st century, and you can't really do that without power. And I think providing clean power is an imperative. I don't think there's a choice, because the business as usual is simply not going to be good enough. And so the one thought that I want to really put out there is that problems now are not going to be able to be solved by any one entity. They're going to require innovative approaches and new ways of thinking that perhaps we haven't really had to do to this extent in the past. And so we're all going to have to come together, and all of us. So philanthropy, which is where I work, entities like yours, Anjali, the private sector, the public sector, civil society writ large, are all going to need to cooperate in possibly unprecedented ways.
Thank you. And Poonam Sandhu, the Senior Clean Energy Finance Expert and Managing Consultant at NRDC, what final thought would you leave us with?
I would say India's path to clean energy is irreversible. It's now commercially viable. It's more cost-effective than traditional power. So what's the need for us to backtrack on it? Things like electric vehicles, electric mobility makes so much sense for India. The oil bill is one of the largest reasons for our deficit. We move on to electric mobility, makes commercial sense. It makes complete economic sense. Sustainable growth, I think that's irreversible. As I said earlier in my piece, it's the general level of public awareness is growing. That adds to the pressure on the government for sustainability. And I think the most critical thing, awareness of youth and children is increasing. And they pretty much realize now that previous generations are on the path to destroying their future and their future world. So there's a lot of that awareness is leading to a lot of action much quicker than it would have happened earlier.
Thank you, Poonam. And finally, Sean Randolph, president of the Bay Area Council and Economic Institute. What would you leave us with?
Just the thought that it is a true imperative for India now to move forward aggressively on this. Last year, and probably into the future, India grew faster than China. It's the largest economy in the world that is fast growing. Last year, India attracted more foreign investment than China did. And so when you look at that trajectory, which will probably go on, and you look at the growing middle classes, urban development, everything that goes with that, you have to manage that growth from an environmental standpoint and from a pollution standpoint, or the consequences are going to be worse and worse. That's before you get to climate change. So you layer climate change on top of that, impacts on water supply and a range of issues. It's an area where it really needs to move forward as rapidly as it can. As a final thought, I'll give an advertisement. Our institute, about 8 years ago, wrote a report on the Bay Area's economic and other ties with India. We're almost done with a new one that will be released at the end of June. India's ambassador is going to come out from D.C. for that event, and it'll be looking at the whole range of transformations in India and the issues in India. But climate and energy is going to be one of those. So I would say look for that at the end of June.
Thank you, and thank you all so much. It's been a really wonderful discussion. Thank you all for being here with us. And I'll just maybe leave you with the thought that I think we've been hearing for a long time about the urgency of climate change, and tonight's discussion has actually been more of an optimistic one of innovation and solutions coming in a country that can be a real world leader and is really stepping out as a world leader on how to solve what is truly one of the most severe problems of our time, while at the same time dealing with the very critical problems at home of air pollution and poverty.
This is Ann Clark, Chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Member-Led Forum. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Our program tonight is NRDC and India's Clean Energy Future. A big thank you to our moderator, Susan Casey-Witz, Chief Program Officer at NRDC. So let's have a round of applause to our moderator.
Oh, to everyone.
Also, another big thank you and applause for our wonderful speakers. Thank you for being here tonight and giving us so much information. I thought it was an excellent program, and I really appreciate your work. And as in the final, our thanks and applause to you, our wonderful audience. We really appreciate you, and we thank you for coming. And to our audiences on the radio, internet, and podcast, thank you for joining us at the Commonwealth Club. And at this point, the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.